see, the date is the 18th, isn't it?
I think it is.
December 18th, 1975, and I think at long last, here we're going to conclude the Southern Oral History Project. And since you and I last talked in Lovejoy, and I was just talking to you about that, there have been a lot of disclosures about various institutions in this country and various individuals. And one of them, of course, is J. Edgar Hoover. And I think Hoover's a man that has enjoyed tremendous respect over the years.
In his lifetime, I suspect he was one of the most admired Americans.
Wasn't he also one of the most powerful?
Yes, he was.
And do you think that that was, did he have too much power?
He possibly did have. I believe it was one of the English lords that said power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. There's some truth in that.
Did, you know, I incidentally filed earlier this year and got my own FBI file under the Freedom of Information Act and found that, you know, that they had kept a file because I had written various articles that Hoover didn't like or the FBI didn't like and so forth. But also they found that a number of political figures and civil rights figures and so forth had files. Do you ever have any idea they kept a file on you?
Well, I suppose it did have. I visited Japan in 1939 as a guest of the Japanese government. And when Ellis Arnold was running against my father in 1942, he portrayed me as somewhat of a traitor at that time, even though I was engaged in combat in the South Pacific.
You mean for having been...
Having gone to Japan as a guest of the Japanese government. Yeah. I presume that might have triggered an FBI investigation on me. I don't know.
Well, you know,
never cared, really.
Yeah, well, you know, I was probably like an awful lot of people my age, say, when I was a kid. I not only looked up to the FBI, but I even applied for a job with them right after I got out of high school and was accepted for a clerical job, but went into newspapering instead. And I know that that you had tremendous respect, and so did everyone else, for the Bureau. What do you think about the disclosures of both the FBI and the CIA, what they've, for example, the plots to assassinate foreign leaders and the information that's come out on that?
It undoubtedly has adversely affected the morale of both agencies, the CIA and the FBI. And senators who have been overseas during the past year tell me that the CIA's sources of information are drying up. All these disclosures undoubtedly has affected the efficiency of both departments, in my judgment, particularly the CIA, whose primary sources of intelligence, of course, are foreigners.
But did you, do you think that the disclosures have been good overall, or?
Overall, in the end, I think it'll have a salutary effect. These things have a way of cleansing themselves. And I don't think you'll ever see circumstances occur like that again during your lifetime and mine.
Would you have ever had any idea at all that, for example, going back to J. Edgar Hoover, that he would have been supplying presidents from Franklin D. Roosevelt on up with political information on various people?
Well, I had assumed they had done that. I remember back during my father's lifetime, he was probably the first Democrat to get at odds with President Roosevelt. And they sicked the types people on him, and they investigated him for 10 years, going to all of his farms, counting chickens and hogs and cows, searching for concealed bank accounts in Cuba and Mexico and Canada. They completed the investigation about the time I returned from the Navy. One of them came up and presented him with a bill, I think, something like $2,000+. And he used some profanity and told them people they thought he owed any income tax school to the courthouse and get him indicted, and he'd meet them there. And that was the end of it. When he died, they never even presented a bill.
And he never paid the bill?
Never paid it.
Yeah. Well, was that accepted then as just sort of hard-boiled politics?
Or yes. Roosevelt was a hard-boiled politician, probably one of the hardest boiled in the history of the country. And I think he thought deep down that all politicians were crooks. And of course, they had moved in on the Long Dynasty, as you remember, mm-hmm. in Louisiana, and sent several of them to the penitentiary, but they never could find anything wrong with my father.
Have there ever been any investigations aimed at you that you know of? I mean, where they've been out in the open?
None that I know of. Yeah. They have denied some depreciation on our ham plant down there a good many years ago. I think I could have gone to court and won it, but politicians can't get in litigation about the income taxes.
Well, I think President Nixon learned that, didn't he?
That's right.
Let me ask you about going back to Nixon, and I guess we'll just skip around on some of the subjects. We never talked about the Ford pardon of Nixon.
I think all Americans had somewhat an ambivalent feeling on that, and that was my own reaction. I don't think many, if any, Americans wanted to see a former president of the United States serving in the penitentiary. But they were indignant that Ford pardoned Nixon before an indictment or a trial. And from his standpoint, it was a grave political error. From the standpoint of the country at large, getting that issue behind us probably was the best thing.
And you still think that? I mean, the timing of the pardon.
Yes, yes.
Mm-hmm. You don't think that there was a deal or anything?
Well, no. I think Gerald Ford is a completely honorable man.
Another issue that I think we didn't touch before, Senator, was your feelings on the Vietnam War.
Well, from the very outset, I thought we were making a mistake getting in there. My own patriotism is somewhat like Stephen Decatur, I believe it was, who said, "My country and my intercourse with foreign countries makes you always be in the right, but my country right or wrong. My loyalty follows the flag and the troops wherever they may be."
Well, did you think that when we did get out, we got out as gracefully or the only way we could? Or
got out about the only way we could. It was a no-win proposition. The country was not behind the war effort. The president was not behind the war effort. When you get involved in a war, the only way to fight it is with every resource the country possesses and go for the jugular vein. We didn't do that. We had our troops over there fighting with one and both hands tied behind them, and the country badly divided and generally non-supportive of the war.
Do you think we should have moved in earlier then and won the war?
Once we committed the troops there, we should have gone all out to win it, and in my judgment, if we'd utilized the full resources of the country at that time, we probably could have won it in 92 days to 6 months.
Currently, there's a discussion going on about how much aid or whether there should be any aid at all the United States put into Angola, and the feeling being that it could be another Vietnam. Do you see it not only there, but the possibility of our getting into any other Vietnam?
I don't think there's a possibility of us committing troops there. I think we learned too great a lesson in Vietnam on that ground. I do think it's a mistake for this country to get involved in these tribal wars, and if Russia moves in, we move in, and vice versa. Because in the long run, I don't think any white power can gain any advantage in Africa under present conditions. They are intensely nationalistic, and I think those countries will either go communist or have some local variety of dictatorship. I think we have nothing to gain by getting involved there.
Well, do you see any other? Are I ever getting involved in any other Vietnams, or do you think the country's really learned that lesson?
I think we've
not
learned,
just Africa.
I think we've learned that lesson. I can only speak for myself. I'm not in favor of getting involved anywhere with any power at any time, anywhere in the world, unless our own direct national security is involved.
Senator, we talked to quite a bit over the previous interviews about your past stand on racial issues and so forth. Is race dead as a political issue in this country?
Well, it depends on how you mean race as a political issue. If you resort to compulsion to move people around to try to get some sort of mythical racial balance, it's the most volatile issue there is in America today. Race as such, ray and blacks against whites, whites against black, I think is relatively dead. Unless you resort to this business of compulsion, which all people resent, black and white.
And that's not an issue today, or is it in Georgia, though, in your own state?
No, it's not an issue in Georgia, except the overwhelming majority of people in Georgia and everywhere else in the nation, both black and white, are violently opposed to this forced busing.
Mm-hmm.
They think it's a denial of their basic freedoms, and I certainly concur.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other areas at all where you see that as an issue?
No.
One thing we did talk about quite a bit was before was when you, in 1966, I believe it was, considered returning to Georgia to run for governor.
Yes.
And I've had some people tell me that that was the one big political mistake that you made, getting involved in that whole exercise of thinking you were going to run, then deciding you weren't going to run. And do you agree with that assessment, that it was a big political mistake?
Well, I don't know what you mean by mistake. I didn't run. It probably would have been a mistake if I had run. Here's what happened in that regard. Vandiver, who had been governor and was expected to run again, was an odds-on favorite to win overwhelmingly, and he had no great substantial opposition, as a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
He called me one day and said, Senator, I need to see you. And I'm coming up to Washington tomorrow morning, arriving at Dulles Airport at such and such a time. It was 5-6 o'clock in the morning, as I recall. I said, well, Ernie, I'll meet you out there and bring you in. We'll have breakfast at the house. So he told me coming in that his doctor told him that he had serious heart trouble, that if he ran for governor, he'd be taking his life in his hands, that he had some young children he had to educate and couldn't afford to sacrifice his family, and he thought I ought to come home and run for governor. He knew that I had been somewhat unhappy in the Senate. All former governors are. A governor can make a decision and execute it. A senator can make a decision and talk about it. There's a tremendous difference between the role of the two. I gave it some thought, and about the next day I announced the fact that I was considering coming home and running for governor, and I had an amazing reaction. Telephones in the office, all of them, and in my residence, were ringing constantly, 24 hours a day. Every few minutes, a stack of telegrams would come in a foot high. Within 48 hours, the mail started arriving. And in the course of 2 or 3 days, we received something like 10,000 communications from Georgia. Politicians, black and white, liberal, reactionary, and moderate, were of one choice only: for God's sakes, come home and run for governor and save us. Now, the rank and file of the people, what we call the butcher, the baker, and the candlestick maker, they had a different reaction. They said the real issues are being fought in Washington now and not in the governor's office. The governor's office is virtually degenerated to a federal clerkship. You've just been in the Senate long enough to begin to render real service there. So Senator Russell is not getting any younger, and we don't want two rookies in the Senate at the same time. Most of them wound up by saying, regardless of what you decide to do, I'll support you. I could see that the politicians wanted me to run, people wanted me to stay in the Senate, and I opted for that course.
Mm-hmm. Can I go back to one other thing? We talked about the base of your support in Georgia, and you've had such broad support. How have you managed to turn people who were opposed to you politically, into your allies?
I think two things, really. You see, when my father died, people were pretty much polarized in Georgia. About a third of the state thought they were going to Gene Talmadge when they died. About a third of the state hated him with a passion. About a third of the state were essentially neutral on him. They voted for him when they thought he was right, against him when they thought he was wrong. And upon his death, I inherited most of his enemies and most of his friends. And I served as governor down there for a little over 6 years, and I think most people I think my administration was one of the better administrations in the history of the state. Some of them, of course, recognized that fact and became my friends instead of my enemies. And then I was never punitive in my political career. I tried to make friends out of my enemies and succeeded to a remarkable degree.
You've had some very powerful friends over the years, and the people who are loom very large, say, on the business or financial front. Who would you count among those in Georgia? Bob Woodruff?
Woodruff, of course, has always been my friend.
Harley Branch?
Harley Branch has always been my
friend.
That's
Georgia Power.
Yes. Contrary to what a lot of people think, they were very minor contributors and sometimes not at all. In fact, I don't think that Harley Branch contributed a very token amount to my race for the Senate, as I recall. I don't recall that he made any contribution at all when I ran for governor. But
they're influential people, yeah.
Yes.
What about other people, Senator, who would be well-known, who have been substantial backers of you? I don't mean substantial.
I think virtually all of the business community has supported me. As you pointed out, my support has been broad-based, particularly in the white community, and in recent years in the black community.
Yeah. Do you recall an incident where you were supposed to speak before the Georgia Teachers Association, and Leroy Johnson was supposed to introduce you or
yes.
something, and at the last minute he didn't do it. Can you tell me what that was about?
I think I was the first white politician in Georgia to accept an invitation to speak before the black teachers group.
That was the Georgia Teachers
Education Association mm-hmm. as I recall. And I was a United States Senator, and Leroy Johnson was the first black senator in Georgia. And they had Leroy Johnson scheduled to introduce me, as I recall. And Leroy didn't show up. I don't know whether he chickened out or had other business.
Mm-hmm. But he didn't show up.
He didn't show up.
Yeah. Let me ask you, I don't remember the year, but back at the time of the county unit system, you and Bob Elliott, who is what now? A
U.S. federal
U.S.
judge.
District judge now, stumped the state at that time, pushing for a constitutional amendment that would extend the county unit system to the general election.
Yeah.
Can you tell me something about that and how?
Well, we lost. We carried most of the counties in the state, as you recall, but the vote in Fulton County was overwhelmingly against it, and that was the difference. We could anticipate at that time that if we didn't get it written in the Constitution that some federal court might junk it, which they ultimately did.
In retrospect, do you look on the county unit system as an instrument that was not fair?
Well, it depends on what you mean by fair. I can understand the feeling in some of the urban areas that they feel that they're being discriminated against, but all Republican forms of government traditionally have recognized the fact that you can't have a republic based essentially on numbers.
Mm-hmm.
We recognize that in our federal system by the U.S. Senate having two senators regardless of population. We recognize that in our presidential elections because it's based on the electoral system. You see, our form of government originally arose in Greece. And the Greeks carried it to the Romans, and the Romans carried it to the English, and ours is derived from that. County unit system was based on the historical basis that every tribe, no matter how small or how remote, would have representation. You still have that in the British Parliament. Of course, your Prime Minister is elected by the members of Parliament, and not all of their districts are equal in population at all. They're very unequal, as a matter of fact.
Senator, what about personal background now? You had a very short-lived early marriage. I saw some news article on it which said that part of the grounds for divorce were that you just had no social life. I think there was a mention of strong cigars and unending political junkets or something. Is that... I mean, you still don't seem to have a tremendous social life.
I've never had much of a social life. In fact, I don't particularly care for it. I enjoy being with friends, having dinner with them, having a drink with them occasionally, but going to cocktail parties and grinning at strangers and hearing the chattering noise doesn't appeal to me at all.
And of course, Washington has a tremendous number of cocktail parties.
I very, very rarely go to any of them. In fact, I don't even go to the White House if I can avoid it. I was invited over there last night to a dance, and I had rejected it.
Yeah. And I think you've told me before, what you do like to do when you leave Washington is go back and hunt or fish or really stay on the telephone with your constituents.
I'll visit around during the Christmas holidays. I have at least 3 quail hunting invitations that I have accepted, and hunting and fishing is my principal relaxation.
Can you tell me now, you and your father together have sort of dominated Georgia politics for almost a half century?
Just about that, yes.
Yeah. What do you see as the Talmadge imprint on the state, and can you tell me something about the difference between your own style and the style of your father?
My father was constantly involved in controversy. He'd have 2-3 major rows and 4-5 minor rows going on all the time.
Did he enjoy that?
Well, I think he did. My style is somewhat different from that. If I can avoid a row, I do so. I don't back away from them, but if you can flank a position rather than storm it, I prefer that.
Your father would rather storm it?
He'd rather storm it, yes. Yeah.
Well, what do you see as, your own imprint?
Well, my imprint, I think, is primarily what I did as governor of Georgia. Mm-hmm. Of course, I've made some contributions since I've been in the Senate, too. I think most of the real progress that our state has made in recent years began with my administration as governor of the state. I'll give you just one illustration. Timber resources alone. When I took office as governor, most of the counties were burning the woods and driving through the state. You'd have to stop during most of the winter and spring months to let the smoke clear away so you could see the roads. In 18 months, we adopted a forestry program. It brought us from 46th position out of the 48 states to number one. Timber resources brings into Georgia now, including the end product, about $3 billion a year. When I took office as governor, it was $300 million a year. That's an increase of tenfold. Now, assuming half of that is attributable to inflation, it's still a fivefold increase.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that, that's merely one example.
What about federal judge appointments during your time as senator? Have you ever had any problem getting people appointed who you were interested in?
No, there was some delay on J. Robert Elliott, and Kennedy was Attorney General at that time, and one of his flunkies was in my office there. Something came up about federal judgeship. I don't think they mentioned Elliott by name. I told him the Constitution of the United States provided that federal judges would be appointed with the advice and consent of the United States Senate, that I had advised and had not yet consented. Elliott's name came to the Senate within 48 hours.
Now, there used to be, I know during the Kennedy administration, sort of trade-offs between President Kennedy and Senator Eastland. If Kennedy would be willing to appoint a certain federal judge, Eastland would be willing, as the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, to approve some other appointment that Kennedy was interested in. Would the same have been true? I mean, did politics work that way as far as you were concerned?
He never tried to make any sort of trade or deal with me on any proposition at any time.
You mean it just wasn't necessary?
Well, it was not only not necessary, but John Kennedy knew me well enough to know that I didn't deal in that manner.
Well, wouldn't that be politics, though, as sort of as...
I have as never played politics accepted? On that basis.
You know, I asked you one time before we sort of dropped the... or discontinued the... last interview of whether or not you had anything else you thought we ought to put in the Southern Oral History Project. You like your history, warts and all. Can you look back and see any warts that people ought to look for when they're trying to judge Herman Talmadge as a public figure that you can think of? If you were reading a biography of Herman Talmadge, some episodes or some part of
the... Oh, I'm sure if I had my life to live over again, there would be some things I would do different.
Is there anything you're willing to...
Hopefully people, as they get older and have more experience, have more knowledge, and utilize that knowledge to better advantage, and I guess that's true not only of Herman Talmadge, but every other individual who ever lived.
Sure. Is there anything, though, that, say, you can look back, that is a matter of public record now, that you could look back and say, well... If I were reading a biography of Herman Talmadge, I'd like to know more about this particular episode in his life.
Not that I can think of at the moment, Jack. Of course, I don't suppose any individual can appraise himself with 100% objectivity.
Yeah, let me ask you something. Going back once more to the segregation thing, you wrote a small book one time about segregation, and then apparently a lot of the copies of the books were picked up, or there are few in circulation in any event, even though there's a Library of Congress card on the book. I forget the title of the book.
You and Segregation.
Yeah, You and Segregation. What was the background of that, and can you tell me why the copies did disappear?
Some publishing house over in Alabama,
Vulcan Press,
asked me to write such a book, and I did, and I don't know what the sales were, what the circulation was, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. Do you look back on that, though, as something you just assumed you hadn't done, or does it make any difference? Or
if they made me the same deal today, I probably would reject it.
You'd probably reject it.
Yeah.
Are you going to write a book?
I have no plans to.
Yeah. About that.
It's not beyond the realm of possibility. Yeah. If and when I retire and have some time on my hands, I might. I have no plans to do so. I haven't kept a diary. Unfortunately, I didn't even keep the papers during the terms that I served as governor. We had no storage facilities for them. We just took them out, all except the official records, my personal papers, and burned them. Unfortunately, my father did the same thing during his career, and the only papers I have are those that I have maintained since I've been in Senate.
And so that if someone were going back over the careers of both Talmadges, the only thing they would have is what's a matter of public record. And
that's right. They'd really, to get a real objective report, they'd have to do like Williams did on Huey Long, do an oral interview. And of course, most of my father's contemporaries are dead, and that's one reason Anderson's book on my father is not objective.
Mm-hmm. There are some, there's no depository at all in Georgia, though, where you could find Eugene Talmadge papers?
Well, I suppose you could find some in the official archives of the state, but that would be only his official acts, and it wouldn't be the copies of his speeches that he gave and things of that nature, except his inaugural addresses, mm-hmm. which would be in the state records.
Mm-hmm. And you can't think of any other sources where historians may, or you know, or someone who's doing a biography.
Well, of course, they could get the newspaper files, but they're not objective, as you know.
Well, but you have to start somewhere, I suppose,
yes.
As a lead for information.
Yes.
Well, Senator,
there's been two or three theses written about my father, but most of the stuff that's been written about my father was either so partisanly favorable or so partisanly unfavorable that it's not very objective.
What about yourself?
Oh, I've had some both ways. I think I've been treated with more objectivity than my father was by the press.
Well, and he was a more controversial
person.
Well, Senator, I've enjoyed it very much.
Pleasure's been mine.
All right. Thank you very much.
I'd give you some coffee, but unfortunately I unplugged it and it's cold.
That's right.
And look forward to progressively lower budget deficits. I don't believe you could say that if we had what you call a simple extension of a tax, because it would not be a simple extension. You know that if they simply extended, they'd simply extend it again next year when the time came around as well. And this is the direction to move in. If we want a slower rise in government, spending, if we want an ultimate reduction in the inflation rate back to the levels that we wish, and as I say, this budget balance in 3 years is important, as is the decision-making back out there.
Mr. Secretary, a question about New York. You said this morning that you thought demagoguery existed in many, many areas on it. Do you consider it engaging in demagoguery if someone says it would default or would injure the recovery?
No, I don't. I think that any judgment on any issue that's backed up with as much analysis as one can put on the subject is absolutely responsible, whether somebody disagrees with it or not. As I've said on quite a few occasions, there are two aspects to a default. One is financial, and the second is psychological. There is no one that can gauge the psychological effects or the psychological impact of a default. It's going into uncharted waters. One can make these very subjective judgments on the effects of a default, but I can say one thing, that the statements that promise a national disaster and the ripple effects and the so-called collapse of the municipal bond market, I consider irresponsible, because in looking at the market the past 4 months, and I'm talking about the municipal bond market, sure, interest rates have gone up in every market. The ratio from tax exempts to taxable remains from prime municipals to prime corporates at 30%, where the subsidy has always been. Sure, there are those credits within the market that are trading well above that. There is no doubt about that. New York City always traded well above it because, A, of its supply, and B, there were those who were concerned about the way it handled its financial affairs. There are other cities that fall in the same category. This flight to quality that commenced at the Penn Central bankruptcy time is going to continue regardless of the outcome. The uncertainty of the situation in New York is also compounding the problem, where investors naturally stay on the sideline until there is a resolution of the problem. And in the interim, we should make these measured judgments and give our opinions on the subject. But certainly these opinions do not include, unless it's qualified, as I have said, that national disaster or economic collapse or what have you is going to come because of. And I've never heard of the because of.
Secretary, yesterday you were asking the Ways and Means Committee whether Dr. Burns fully supported this plan or approved of it. And you said, yes, he certainly does. And this morning at the Joint Economic Committee, Dr. Burns said he would only approve of a plan like that if the spending cuts went into effect the same time as the tax cuts, and that he had some doubts about the lag time in between under the president's approval. Was he fully briefed on this?
Arthur sat in a room with all of us every discussion we had on this issue. Yes, Arthur is one of the, as you know, one of the key economic advisors, and the president is very careful in all of our deliberations with him and going around the room individually, and I can assure you that none of his advisors ever hesitate whether we think you'll agree or disagree, to give our very honest opinion and very strong opinion if it's warranted.
Were you aware of that reservation that he had?
No.
Mr. Secretary, not one of your predecessors once urged another cabinet member to keep his cotton-picking hands off the economic matters. I wonder what you think about Secretary Dunlop, who's been running around advocating this extension, indefinite extension of the tax cuts, which is more or less considered to be in the Treasury's ballpark.
I don't think any of the economic advisors to the President should be prohibited from speaking on the subject of economics. I fully support anyone giving their honest opinions in congressional testimonies. That's what we're here for. Give honest opinions. There is no such thing as cotton-picking hands. We've got an Economic Policy Executive Committee. John is a very important member of that committee. He voices his opinions just as I voice mine. And the President lays all of the various judgments and makes the decisions.
Mr. Secretary, Dr. Burns of the Joint Economic Committee today said he was not today prepared to recommend legislation to help New York, but then he went on to say that it's a close question and he might change his mind, and if Congress decided that such legislation should be enacted, he laid out his proposals for what it should contain. Do you think it's that close a question, and what do you think of...
Well, I don't know. I didn't hear that part where Arthur said it was a close question.
He said that he could understand if other members of Congress would decide that it was the right thing to vote for.
That's a different story.
And then he laid out a scenario of what the legislation should contain.
Well, that's fine. Now, if asked, and perhaps I will be tomorrow, as to what I think, you're going to read my testimony tomorrow, and you will see what the administration's position is. But then you're always pressed in testimony, and people say, okay, we've got your position. Now, supposing we decided to go the other way, what would be the best way, in your judgment, for us to go?
That isn't the way it was this morning.
Well, no, the point is that I'd be glad to tell them what I think, and I very definitely think an RFC-type mechanism is definitely not the route we should go if Congress decided to pass aid for municipalities under any guise in this country. I don't think the establishment of a new bureaucracy is the method it should be done.
Could you?
You still do not favor any sort of legislation in this area.
No, I do not.
Mr. Secretary, despite the best efforts, Congress may well pass a tax cut without a spending ceiling. In the event that the President is then obliged to veto such a tax cut, are you concerned that the resulting stalemate will lead to harm, perhaps irreparable harm to the economy?
No, absolutely not. The President is going to veto a simple extension of the tax cut in the absence of the resolution on the spending ceiling. A simple extension, whether it was $10 or $12 billion in that area in a $1.5 trillion economy, is going to show vigorous positive real growth. I don't think I consider that consequential. System. I add to that.
I think you would really have much greater confidence in econometric models to say that $5 or $10 billion in the economy would make the difference thereof. I think personally that the combination of a tax cut will supplement, perhaps fill in some gaps in the pace of the recovery we have. I speak mainly to the point of personal consumption, which I consider to be vital in the near term. Then draw business capital investment to reinforce the recovery. So I think that one is not talking here about aborting a recovery. One is really talking about the strength and sustainability of a recovery. And I believe, and have believed, that the tax cut extension would make that more sure and more certain, and I'm favored on that basis.
One thing before we shut it off, any other questions or charts or comparisons that you would like, if you get in touch with the office, as I say, I'm sure we have them available to make sure that you have all the information you need on the proposal. Thank you, gentlemen.